It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. She's known as the trans handy ma'am on TikTok, and she has a big heart for renters because she is one. We welcome back Wisconsin's own Mercury Stardust and tackle things that need fixing, drains that need unclogging, and other helpful tips to make a home comfortable. Call in with a question. You can share comments along the way. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mercury Stardust is a professional home maintenance technician, performer, and activist. Her book is called Safe and Sound, A Renter-Friendly Guide to Home Repair. Mercury, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, hi. How's it going this morning?
It's going well. So glad you're here. And, you know, you think renters are overlooked in home maintenance. So why do you think renters get short shrift?
I think it's because we have this notion that if it isn't a property, we don't really have a say with it. And I think that that conversation right out of the gate is a very one that's filled with inequities. You know, I think that it's hard sometimes for people to understand why someone would want, you know, to have a say in their home, you know? And I think that the reason why we wrote the book was basically to start this conversation and to try to open up the gates a little bit when it comes to this information in our own homes.
Yeah, renters are often people who are viewed as lesser, you say, just because they're renters. They don't own that property. They don't own that land. And that has a ripple effect.
Yeah. And a lot of renters are also people who are in the LGBTQIA community or are in other marginalized communities. We have to look at renters not just as people who don't have a house, but often are people with other marginalized identities that might be affected when we're talking about the economic disparities in the country.
So you have what you call a checkity checklist. This checklist you should get from your landlord to document the state of your home when you move in. Why emphasize this documentation?
The more that we document everything from emails with our landlords and technicians, and the more that we document like what's already wrong when we move in, the more we're protected when we're moving out. So if we know, hey, you know, that base trim when in the kitchen is damaged, that we're not going to get charged for that when we're moving out of a rental. And those kind of things are super, super important when we're talking about just protecting our finances.
Mm-hmm. And you also recommend negotiating the lease through email. So a lot of digital documentation going on here.
Yeah, take photos of everything. Everything that you could document and put into like, you know, put into the cloud or put into Google Drives is all good. You know, we're in this wonderful time of almost too much information in the world. So I think it's good to just kind of like contribute to that and have that in your back pocket, because we don't always remember what's wrong. And in the rule of court, we need to have evidence in order to support what our claims are.
How common is it for landlords to not return a renter's security deposit?
I think, you know, when it comes to how actually common, if I looked on data, I think the data would probably suggest that it leans on a side of more for the landlord and a little bit less for the tenant. But it's really hard to say that, you know, for sure without having a lot of data. And data is different for everyone across the whole country. Mm-hmm. I will say that the majority of renters feel like we don't get our deposits back. And the debate over what constitutes as not getting the deposit back and why is just one that's sometimes really hard to quantify. And we don't see a lot of renters take landlords to court because, I mean, it's really expensive to do so. And sometimes we're only arguing about like $400 or $500. And for a renter, that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. For a landlord, that's a drop in the hat. So that could be really difficult for us to be able to get support from the court system.
And it's really, you know, in terms of damages, it's such, you know, the eye of the beholder. I mean, what is considered normal wear and tear and what is considered actual damage? It can be different for every eye.
It can also be different for how long you've lived there for. You know, like every passing year, we are dealing with more different kinds of normal wear and tear. If you've been there for 7 to 8 years, most carpets in, you know, in rentals don't last that well. You know, this is on the cheaper side sometimes. Sometimes you do run into some really nice carpet, but most of the time it's carpet that's going to wear out between 7 to 8 years. And if you've lived here for 10 years and your carpet is still immaculate, then why is it when you call for a new appliance, they push back against you? You know, like, I think that we have such, you know, this tenuous situation between, I need to make sure I protect myself financially because, you know, this isn't an investment for me. And then you see the other side where this is actually my shelter. This is how I stay warm in winter. This is how I stay dry in the summer. And those two things feel very incompatible sometimes when we're having these disagreements and arguments.
Mercury Stardust, our guide to home maintenance, and has a new book out called Safe and Sound. You can join in the discussion, call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So Mercury, when you're deciding on a potential place to rent, you know, you mentioned about, of course, documentation, but you also like to know how long a typical tenant stays in the apartment. Why is that relevant?
That's a really good point. So when people are moving into a new place, knowing how long the previous tenant was there for is a great indication of like what's going on. I lived in about 8 different rental places in a course of about 10 years. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that, like, I couldn't get settled. It wasn't because I didn't want to stay there. Well, it was because, oh, maybe it was too small, it didn't fit my needs, or I got pushback from the landlords, or felt uncomfortable with communication, or didn't feel safe with the landlord, didn't feel safe with the technicians. You know, there's so many lists of things. Finding a home, especially in the rental market, can be really hard when it comes to location, where your job is, to where your home is. So all of those factors go into how I am debating about living at a place. And one of the major ones is if that person who lived there prior to me lived there for like 2, 3, or 4 years, that might be an indication that it was at least a good enough a place to sign multiple years of leases for. The days where we could sign a 3-year lease are gone. We live in an era right now where signing 1-year lease is kind of the standard almost everywhere across the country. And when we find a place where it's a monthly list, that's even more rare these days. So being able to know that the person signed multiple 1-year leases is a really good indication that this might be a place that you can at least settle in for the next couple of years.
Well, let's take a call now. Ethan is joining us from Whitewater. Ethan, hi, what's on your mind?
Hey, I was just curious. I know there's a lot of different information out there, but most leases that I've ever signed, the landlord will include something about carpet cleaning that must be done by a professional company. And like you said, you know, you can keep the carpet as clean as it can possibly be, but they'll still charge you for that. And then I've, in some cases, just seen them come in with a Stanley steamer or something that they told me I could not do.
Yeah, there is. So when people are moving out, especially, there is this notion within the industry in which I was in for 17 years that we want to make sure that we have evidence that things were done properly, right? And when we are paying someone for their service, instead of just relying on people to do the work themselves, that is more to protect us in a legal sense than it is to protect us in almost anywhere else. And, you know, we get a lot of pushback on this kind of stuff. Like people within the industry, when I mention this, get upset that that's how I view it. But I was in the industry for 17 years and I know the communication we had behind closed doors. And it was very much about like making sure we have a paper trail, because as people who own the property, we can protect ourselves by making sure that we have a long, strong a paper trail. And if someone complains, oh, hey, the carpet doesn't look clean, we can be like, oh, actually, we did this about 3 to 5 weeks ago, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a way to just basically look good, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, carpet within the industry is such a standard to replace it after someone moves out that it's often kind of a chuckle when people live in a place for 3 to 4 years and them not replacing their carpets. These carpets don't hold up very well. They're very thin. They're usually corrugated carpet, which means that they pull apart at the seams. And it's not uncommon to go into a place and see several runs that are indications that this carpet may need to replace anyways.
Mercury Stardust is a professional home maintenance technician in Wisconsin. The guidebook to common repairs, it's called Safe and Sound. And you can join the conversation with a question. You can share your thoughts at any point. Call in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here in the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, professional home maintenance technician in Wisconsin. Mercury Stardust is a lifelong renter, has a guidebook that is focused on renters and how to proactively fix dozens of home maintenance issues, along with tips on how to effectively communicate with a landlord. Be part of this discussion as Mercury troubleshoots. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mercury, you know, you've got these freshly painted walls as you move in. They're, you know, begging for something to be there to make it, you know, something that feels like home. And you write about using painter's tape as a way to help hang something on a wall. Can you explain this technique?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you got like a painting or you have something that has two holes in the back of it, if you put painter's tape on the back of it and you mark off where the holes line up and then take that painter's tape and put it in a level and then mark it off on the wall using a level, mm-hmm. then boom, you got it. You know exactly where the holes are. You know exactly that it's level. And this can take less than a minute and a half to 2 minutes. It's so much faster than what I was taught when I was younger. And that was just to guess and pray.
And it's those little things, because when you walk by, it's straight and it's not, you know, hanging in an odd way that catches your eye. I mean, you want those little things to be just right.
Yeah.
Let's go to
details.
Details matter. Let's go to Lanny in Ashland. Lanny, hi.
Well, hello. How are you guys?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I don't know. I'm a 72-year-old man, and I've owned a lot of property. I've owned a lot of rental property, and now I'm renting again, you know, in Ashland because I got rid of my big house. But I'd like to tell the viewers or the listeners that, you know, make sure you watch your P's and Q's when you live in a rental place. I mean, you know, if the carpet, maybe take some pictures before you move in, you know, how the place was, because at the end, you know, when you're moving out, your mind's really not right there. You've got something else on concern. But I think, you know, proof is in the pudding. And the more notes you take and the more pictures you take, whatever, the more proof you have, you got something to stand on. That's basically all I got to say.
Lanny, thank you for that. Mercury, I think you'd probably say amen there.
Absolutely. Documentation is so important. And I think it's another important topic to talk about is a lot of people, when we are aging, find ourselves back in rental properties for the first time in sometimes many years. I did a 54-city book tour last year, and I met so many people. But the amount of people who I met that were seniors was a wild amount, not what I thought I would see. From my demographic of listeners and followers, but there are a lot of people who are elderly who are now, in the first time in sometimes 40 to 50 years, are renters again. And it can be really a culture shock, especially when you're calling the shots for a long time and all of a sudden you're not. And I think that's another important topic to have when we're discussing these type of things.
Jerry in Verona called in and says that they believed Illinois might have had a renters union and people could call in, tell about their situation, and the union would negotiate on their behalf. And Jerry says it's a good idea to have that representation on both sides. What are your thoughts there?
In an ideal world, every single apartment complex and every single rental property would have a renters union. And it is, these are starting to become more and more popular. They can start by just one person in a complex saying, hey, if we all work together, we can make sure that our voices are heard. It is very difficult, in the reality to get these started and to actually have them last, but I'm a huge advocate for it. I really do think there's a lot of landlords get very skittish around this idea, but I really do think it's beneficial for all of us to have open communication and all of us to have our voices heard, and also to understand that you may own the property, but these are people's homes and they should have a say with what happens in their own community. Often landlords or technicians don't even live in the communities in which they're providing services for. And I think that could be a huge factor when we're talking about this. We need to better our communities, and we do that by giving each other voices.
Mercury Stardust with us, new guidebook out, professional home maintenance technician and focused on renters. You can call in with questions, 800-642-1234. Chris in Eau Claire is here. Chris, hi.
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. I was wondering, for that question about negotiating rental terms, would you know if there's a difference between family-run versus a corporate, I guess, rental provider, and if there are certain things you can or can't do in either case?
Such a good question. First and foremost, when we're talking about family-run property management companies, usually this means somewhere that's under like 10 properties. It can really range. Sometimes it's just one person and their basement, you know? But when you're dealing with that, you're going to be able to have a lot more leeway. It becomes way, way more individualized when we're talking about smaller property companies. When we're talking about corporate properties, it is a huge legal battle, right? They're dealing with hundreds, sometimes thousands of properties. And that means that they're going to have a lot less leeway. They might not be as willing to cut the corners on something because if they're doing it for one, it may open it up for hundreds. And that imbalance can be difficult to work with. So it's always good to ask the question and it's always good to get it all in writing, but just know you may not hear what you want going in. And in the state of Wisconsin, especially, we don't have a whole lot of leeway. It is more like a seller's market than it is a buyer's market in a lot of ways, right? Mm. It's harder for us to find properties right now in Wisconsin that fit our needs as renters than the other way around.
Thinking about how the management company might not even be in Wisconsin, and if there is an emergency, like let's say your apartment, your home is broken into, what should your landlord and you do? What should be, you know, how do you address a scary emergency?
Oh, the first thing I will say is that we should always have renter's insurance. I think that that's a huge part of it. When it comes to someone breaking into your apartment, especially, one of the first things that we're going to ask from a property management standpoint is, you know, did the person have the key? Do you have all the keys? And we still might change the lock and all that anyways. And then we need to change the lock if we get a police report. So legally, I don't think I was allowed to do a lot of stuff unless there was a police report. So remember that even though sometimes we might not want to get the police involved for so many reasons, that legally we kind of have to have a paper trail in order to make sure we can get some jobs done. But when it comes to like our actual safety themselves, I talk to people about Google Homes, you know, having some type of security system set up with cameras is always good. I like to err on the side of caution. Be aware that in some leases, it does indicate that you're not allowed to put up cameras facing the entrance or the exits of your apartment unless you get permission from the property management company. So be aware that there are some tricky language when it comes to this stuff. But I believe that if you're a landlord, we should allow people to be able to protect themselves with the means that they have. And if they're not able to put a large permanent lock on the door, at the very least, let us use temporary devices to protect ourselves.
Mercury Stardust is a professional home maintenance technician in Wisconsin, author of a new guidebook on common fixes around the house. And you can join the discussion along the way. Call in with the question, add your home repair tips at any point. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss handy home repairs with Mercury Stardust, known as Trans Handy Ma'am on TikTok and a professional home maintenance technician in Wisconsin. New guidebook is focused on renter-friendly repairs. And we heard from Carol in Lake Geneva, former apartment manager, who says number one way to get your security deposit back, just clean the place, Carol says, including your oven. You can be part of the discussion on DIY fixes. Call in with the question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Let's go to another Carol. This is Carol in Milwaukee. Hi, go ahead.
Good morning. I would like to talk about Milwaukee's situation. There are not enough building inspectors. My building inspector told me, after he got through helping me for 3 months, it took him to get a total of 4 months before I got the squirrels out of my house because my landlord didn't want to do it, get rid of them, it seemed like, because he could have gotten rid of the squirrels within 1 month. But anyway, I think he could have. But anyway, the building inspector told me he was very nice and everything. But he said, we can't waste time on small issues like yours. Don't call again if you want to help the city, because the city has to take all these I think they're the new landlords who don't really live here, which is most of the rentals. We have to take them to court. They will not do anything when we give them reprimands. They wait to be taken to court. So I guess these building inspectors do not have time for all the problems in the city. That's my opinion.
Carol, thank you for bringing that to the table. Wasting time on small issues, but squirrels doesn't seem to me, Mercury Stardust, like a small issue.
See, what Carol was bringing up is actually a larger issue, and that's out-of-state landlords and the battles and the legal issues that we're having across the country. We've never seen it quite this way before. You know, we've always had out-of-state landlords at a pretty high rate across the country. It has increased quite a bit in the last couple of years. And it's made it really, really difficult for local legislations to be able to enforce the laws that they have. And so what you're hearing in this discussion is a complete exhaustion of the systems we have in place. I don't actually think squirrels is a small issue. I think that can lead to a very big issue, but I don't know all the issues that the inspector is seeing, right? I mean, they could be dealing with so many large, crazy issues that a squirrel living in your home may be a pretty small one to them. But to us, when we're living in the space, those kind of things can be so disruptive. And add to a worsening life quality, right? So it can be difficult, but also understand that this is not the problem of the inspector. This is the problem of the landlord. But trying to get enforcers and support to take care of it, they've put a really hard strain on our system, and it shows.
Well, one of the tips you provide, I've even put it to work right away. When you do finally get that maintenance technician in your apartment, in your home, get their expertise while you have it. And I really love that advice. What more can you say there?
I think that a lot of times we can just watch them. We can be in their presence. We can, once we get a few couple of words from them, right? If they diagnose the problem, we're able to actually Google. We live in a world where if we have the right word choices and have the right knowledge on and what we're looking at, we can do a lot of the research. But often we don't even have the framework to Google, you know, the plumbing issue or the electrical issue or, you know, all those type of issues that we may have. But if we're able to just get a few keywords, maybe we can look it up in my book or look it up on Google. And that's a great start. I think that never be relaxed on trying to find information that may help you now or maybe 5 or 10 years down the road. You never know when information comes in handy.
And you have the Mercury method. It's, you know, to identify and tackle these difficult issues. Can you walk us through the Mercury method?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm a firm believer that if we can troubleshoot things, if we can kind of look at problems, it doesn't necessarily matter if we are someone who is never done this repairs or not, because a lot of those things can be solved if we just kind of walk through our steps of figuring it out. One of the very first steps is about isolating the problem, right? We want to identify and then isolate the problem. Once we can kind of figure out how the problem is happening, like let's say for an instance we're dealing with a door not opening properly, right? Well, if we can isolate the problem and we can find out what is the issue, is it the hinge itself, the hinge rusted, is it beyond repair, do we need to replace it, or are we looking at maybe do we need to plane the top of the door, do we need to change the pins and the hinges? If we can isolate what is causing the problem itself, then we can actually implement, then we can actually start working on the problem. And that's kind of what the Mercury method is. It's just a new way of looking at troubleshooting and kind of giving us various steps to kind of make sure that we can solve the problem itself.
And at the end of the method, you suggest that we breathe. And I'm wondering, you know, kind of taking stock, taking a moment, why are those emotional resets really important?
Studies have shown that when people are in emotional heightened states, that we don't take in or retain as much information. And I think when we are trying to educate ourselves, especially, it can be a really frustrating experience, because we may mess up or we may not feel like we are adequate in order to do these jobs. But if we remind ourselves to breathe, to try to stay as calm as we possibly can, we actually retain and take in more information, and that can help us. And remember, we don't know what we don't know. Beating yourself up about something you did not know previously, to me, is really beneficial to, not beneficial to learning and growing and taking care of ourselves.
Mercury Stardust, our guide to home maintenance technician. You can call in with your repair questions, comments, experiences, 800-642-1234. Key in Madison is here. Key, hi. Are you there?
Hi.
Hi, yes.
I'm here.
Go ahead.
Hi. Okay. So I live in an apartment building in Madison, and it's from the 1980s, and I've lived here 3 years, and I'm having recurring mold. And I know that the humidity is an issue, so I put on the heat light that's on the ceiling, and then I put on the Brone, what they call an exhaust fan, which is on the wall. And, well, while the maintenance person was here fixing the Johnny ring in the toilet, I asked him about it, and he said, because the fan is blowing in, like I put a lighter up there once and it just blew the light, it blew the flame out. And he said, oh, well, that's not vented to the outdoors. That doesn't do anything. That's supposed to blow in. And I really felt like I was being gaslighted. And I really appreciate what you just said about not being able to take in and retain information when you have a heightened sense of this. And that's how I feel when the maintenance person comes over.
Yeah, it could be really hard, right? Like when we're talking to maintenance technicians, it can be really difficult because there's a power dynamic that they might not even be aware of. A lot of technicians, you know, we clock in, we clock out, and we're almost detached from what the realities are for the people who are living there. And I think that we don't talk about it enough in our industry about how we're dealing. These are really important jobs. And many of us in the industry are considered, you know, emergency workers in some ways. A lot, like I was an emergency call often, and I would show up people's houses at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, at very difficult times. And I think we need to have empathy and compassion for those moments. But to help with the molding issue.
Meanwhile, the mold.
I think it's really important to talk about dehumidifiers, especially in bathrooms. So you're not alone, Key. In the state of Wisconsin, when it comes to bathrooms having the proper exhaust systems, it can be actually kind of an uphill battle. A lot of these places were ushered in before certain codes kind of came in. So they're kind of protected underneath the law. You know, they don't necessarily have to make them as airflowy as they should, right? But dehumidifiers can be a huge asset. They're going to make sure that that moisture is being sucked out while it's happening. And that's a good thing. Okay. So I always think of dehumidifiers being applied 20 minutes before a shower and then 20 minutes after the shower. And if you do that, you're going to notice a pretty significant drop in mold growth and spreading.
You also write that bleach is not the right product for getting rid of mold. What would you use instead?
Any type of product that has bleach, that has mold killer in it, right? You want to try to kill it as much as you can, and using it 3 to 5 times a week is good. Vinegar is another one. If we're looking for a low cost solution, vinegar is actually a lot better than bleach. Bleach, can it kill the mold? Yeah, but it's hard to actually get to the source of it. You have to go through drywall and paint and plaster and then go to the back of it. And that can be really difficult. You're not really solving the problem. What we want is to try to keep the spread of it down as renters and try to make sure that it's not going to get into the air. So getting vinegar can actually neutralize the components of the bacteria and the mold and can actually help us from keeping it out in the air and stuff. So do that and then use a dehumidifier on top of that. And within 3 to 4 weeks, you'll start seeing results.
Ooh, and that distilled white vinegar. I'm loving it on shower doors to get rid of all of the that sediment that builds up. It is fabulous.
Yeah, the white vinegar is a savior. We honestly, like when it comes to repairs, I always kept a little bit of a bottle with me in my bag all the time because you could use it for so much different stuff.
Well, let's bring in Nancy now in Milwaukee. Nancy, what's going on?
I live in a duplex. I have lived here for 47 years, and both the upper and lower apartment doors were put on wrong. They open outward instead of inward. This is actually a very unsafe situation because anybody trying to get and successfully getting in from the outside could just easily take these doors off their hinges and get into the apartments. So I am lately deciding to call in a handyman to take the doors down and reposition them so that they open the correct way, which is what should have been done to begin with. So my question is, can a average handyman do that, or should I call a carpenter who has gone through a carpenter's apprenticeship program?
Such a good question, Nancy. I will say right out of the gate that it all depends on how everything is structured. I would say that we could do that stuff pretty easily as maintenance technicians. Most of the time, it was a couple hours job, but we could do the job. As far as is it possible in this situation, without me looking at it, I couldn't tell you definitively if it is going to be one that we could do without having a carpenter intervention. But it can be something that can be done if it's the right kind of frame. If it's an exterior door, chances are it will be a much more difficult route. And you may need a carpenter to kind of help this project along and get some people who do door hanging professionally every day rather than just a technician who does it once in a while.
Mercury Stardust, professional home maintenance technician in Wisconsin, fielding your questions on home repair projects and things you want to fix to make your space more livable. Call in to find out if Mercury can troubleshoot at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Wisconsin-based professional maintenance technician Mercury Stardust as our guide to home projects and repairs. New guidebook is called Safe and Sound, and it includes step-by-step instructions on how to fix dozens of home maintenance issues. You can call in with yours. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Okay, Mercury, we're going to turn our attention to garbage disposals that you call not magical go-away machines. Where does the food go in the disposal?
Once it goes down into the disposal, it gets eat up by a dinosaur. No, it gets all chumped up real small and tiny, and then it goes down into our sewage waste system. And that's actually a really good segue to how we should remember that just putting anything down in a garbage disposal isn't a great idea. And that remember that all because you can put it down there doesn't mean you should. And that we should be mindful of our local communities and try to make sure we prevent of a larger sewage issue. Our infrastructure system in the country is getting quite old. And as we have read probably many articles across the country for the last several years, a lot of these infrastructures are not able to handle the high income of sewage or traffic. And it's important that we're doing our part to make sure that we're not adding to a larger issue that may be developing, especially when it comes to those darn flushable wipes. Oh, because it says flushable wipes does not mean you should flush the wipes.
So when you talk about our infrastructure across the country, it reminds me that you've just seen the country. You were on this 54-city book tour. What was one of your favorite moments or interactions on the tour?
Meeting trans kids across the country was something that is so special that I can't put into words. As as someone who is considered an elder in the trans community, which makes me just shake my head for so many reasons. But as someone who is a role model for kids now within my own trans community, it has been a beautiful thing to watch. Seeing trans kids see an adult who is successful and a number one New York Times best-selling author is so rare. 0.01 authors will achieve something like that. And I'm so lucky and privileged to be in that position to be able to show kids that we can be who we are and also do the things we want to do. I met an amazing kid in Columbia, Ohio, who wanted to be like an astrophysicist, and they were only 11 years old, and they knew more about science than I think I have ever heard in my entire life. And these are amazing, extraordinary kids with amazing, extraordinary parents who are willing to do anything for them. And I think that seeing this many people across the country with that many cities was just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and I'm so thankful I got to go on it.
Have you been changed by that, by these experiences?
Yeah. I think that for a long time online, I felt like this was a burden. I don't really necessarily like being in the public eye. But when I see the good that we're able to do by having the discussions like we're having today, and I see the good that we're doing by raising, you know, like $2 million for gender affirming care, like we did last year by using my platform, we're helping and changing lives long beyond my lifetime. We're going to be helping people for a long time because of the words that I'm sharing, the inspiration that we're giving, and the hope that we're instilling into our youth. And I get to see that right in front of me now when I traveled around the country. And I don't think you can be the same person when you come back from something like that. You have to be mindful of how impactful you are. And that means we're kind of playing the long game and making sure that I'm going to be here doing the things I'm doing for the next 30 years.
And meanwhile, also, you know, trying to figure out all the tools in the toolbox. I mean, you know, being a maintenance technician, things are always changing. You're always probably feeling like you're just trying to keep up. Is that challenging?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of. I mean, you know, I always talk about the duality of what my job is, right? My job is part activism and about advocacy for renters and also my own trans community, right? Mm-hmm. And another part of it is making sure that I know what miter saws are on the market. that dichotomy is so funny, you know? Like, I'll be sitting here one day making a table saw, miter saw combination table, and the next day I am, you know, talking with, you know, a lawyer about advocacy for, you know, a small community. And it's really interesting kind of where I find myself, and trying to remember that I can't be everything for everybody, but I can be everything for individuals. And that's what I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to help as many people as I can individually.
Well,
I think that goes in solving larger problems.
Well, here comes Adam and Nina with a quick question. Oh. Adam, hi.
Hello.
What would you like to ask?
Well, I had a question. Kind of a longer story, but I'll try to keep it short. Basically, New Year's Eve morning, early hours, our carbon monoxide detector, we currently rent a single-family home. And at early morning on New Year's Eve, our carbon monoxide detectors went out. Everyone got out safe. Fire department came. And they said that what happened was that the previous night, we have a wood-burning fireplace in our living room. And we had a fire the previous day, and I let it smolder like normal overnight to go out. And they said when the heat kicked on in the morning, that the cold air returns basically reversed the flow of the chimney and sucked into the house. So they said to vent out the house, everyone, and that was what was causing it. It wasn't the furnace or anything.
Okay.
Like that.
And Adam, I'm so sorry to cut you short here. A carbon monoxide detectors, mercury, any advice there?
I'm making sure that we have them in the right locations is actually kind of a lifesaver too. You know, what Adam was just talking about is a really good reasoning why we should have multiple throughout the home, especially when we're dealing with ones that have chimneys.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's a really good, important contribution of the conversation itself. Making sure we have them and making sure we're checking them. They all have testers. We should be testing them a couple times a year, too minimal, I would say. Same thing with fire alarms, too. And we should understand that smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors are not the same thing. And we should be mindful of that as well.
Mercury, such a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you.
Oh, Mercury Stardust, author of Safe and Sound, A Renter-Friendly Guide to Home Repair. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is home to about 6,000 dairy farms, more than any other state. Nearly 1.3 million cows and counting, and those figures from our state agriculture department. We take a deep dive into what rural means and how the land is changing. And you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Stephen Kahn is a history professor at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. New book is called The Lies of the Land, Seeing Rural America for What It Is and Isn't. Steve, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me, Kate. This is a thrill.
Good. You write about how Americans often talk about rural life using both the language of crisis and the language of myth. And you take particular issue with the word crisis. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, I think over the last, I don't know what it's been now, 5, 8 years, this is the word, if you look in the newspapers, that comes up repeatedly when we talk about what's going on in rural places. And I'm a historian, so I need to go back. And what I discovered is that, in fact, people have been talking about rural America in crisis every decade since probably the 1870s and maybe even before that. I didn't go all the way back. And so if you could sort of look at every decade and somebody is talking about how rural America is in crisis, I sort of was starting to scratch my head and think, well, when was rural America therefore not in crisis? And therefore maybe that's not the right way for us to be talking about this in the first place.
Why are you challenging these long-held views of rural America?
Well, I think it starts. I'm gonna get a little autobiographical here. Mm-hmm. I'm a big city kid. I grew up in Philadelphia. I lived on the East Coast, and then I moved to Ohio, and now I live in a very small town, surrounded by corn and soybean fields, and I teach in a slightly larger town. Also surrounded by soybean and corn fields. And so I guess with these two perspectives, I just didn't think that the conversation we were having about rural America was getting us anywhere. I didn't think it was very useful. And so I thought, well, is there a different way? Can I bring a different set of lenses to look at all of this? Because what I was reading, what I was finding, just as I said, seemed to go round and round. It's about a crisis. It's about a crisis. It's about a crisis. And I just am not sure that's gotten us anywhere. So I thought I'd look into it myself.
You bring up about some outside perspective. A friend of yours from China told you that Chinese people who come to the U.S. call our rural areas the big empty. And you say that that phrase stuck with you. What significance does the big empty have?
Yeah, I love that phrase. And I really, my colleague who gave it to me, I owe her a debt. I think one of the things that I was really struck by the first time I ever went to visit China, which was about 25 years ago, was going in between these Chinese cities, these big Chinese cities, through the Chinese countryside and realizing just how busy it all was. Whereas in this country, we associate being out in the country with being really not, you don't see anybody. There's nobody out there. It's all kind of empty. And I think that that's part of the mythology, or that sort of underscores the mythology that we have about rural places, that they are empty, that they are somehow tranquil and they don't change a lot. And that's what we want to see when we go out there. It's not really true. They may be empty of people, but that doesn't mean they aren't empty in all kinds of other ways.
Hmm. You know, I introduce you by counting the number of farms we have here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And I wonder, does that ignore other kinds of rural places? Because I feel like, at least I do, have the, when I think of rural, I think of farms.
Yep. So this might not be the best way to start off a book, but I think the very first sentence in my book is, a book about rural America is a ridiculous idea. Because as you're driving at here, there are all different kinds of rural places. Rural places are farms. Yes, that's kind of what we think of, but they're also mining areas and timber areas, which was, you know, folks who live up in the northern parts of Wisconsin are certainly aware of all of that. They constitute desperately poor areas of the country. It's where a majority of Indian reservations are found, right? They constitute some of the richest counties in the country, like Teton, Wyoming, which claims to be the wealthiest county per capita in the United States. So, right, rural America is a vastly diverse place, but I do think that when we talk about it, when we use the language, we're projecting an image of family farm. And that's sort of part of what I also wanted to deconstruct a little bit here, was to get us to see these places in a much more multiplicitous sort of way.
Reexamining depictions of rural America, Steve Kahn, our guide, history professor, author of the new book, The Lies of the Land. You can join in along the way. Your questions and comments are welcome. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Steve, you say, you know, widespread views of rural life are often romanticized and depicted as ideal and healthy and simpler. Where do the romanticized views come from?
Well, they come all the way back. They go all the way back to the 18th century. And I'm sure many readers, many of your listeners will recognize the phrase of Thomas Jefferson's when he talked about the United States as a nation of yeoman farmers. Mm-hmm. Was Jefferson himself a yeoman farmer? Absolutely not. But he had a projection of what ought to be, that we should be a nation of land-owning, self-sufficient, agrarian people. And it's not clear that that was ever the case. But that fantasy, that, as I said, that mythology persisted. You find it persisted. You see it in writings across the 19th century. In the 20th century, it gets reinforced in radio shows and television shows and articles in the Saturday Evening Post and things like this. It's really, for I think a lot of urban and metropolitan Americans, rural America is a blank slate. And it's onto which we can simply project what we wish rural America was really like.
You know, the view being that rural America is nearly entirely white, who is left out of this rural America when you look at the people living in sparsely populated areas?
Sure. That's a great point. Rural America, again, depending on where you are in the country, has always been home to African Americans, to Native people, to people of Hispanic origins one way and another. And that's also still the case. One of the ways in which this rural white mythology is perpetuated in the popular culture is through country music. And one of the things I think you don't hear much when you listen to country music are songs about Central American slaughterhouse workers in Iowa. But those rural slaughterhouses in Iowa are staffed by people who are all speaking Spanish, and they tend, therefore, those sorts of people tend to get ignored as we project this image of kind of little house on the prairie onto rural America.
Miami University of Ohio history professor Steve Kahn's new book, it's called The Lies of the Land, Putting Rural America into Sharper Focus, What It Means. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is known as America's dairy land, over 64,000 farms and roughly 14 million acres. That's from the State Agriculture Department. We explore attributes of rural Wisconsin and America and how this land is changing. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Steve Kahn is a history professor at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. Book is called The Lies of the Land. Steve, we're going to turn to the Army Corps of Engineers. And one of your chapters really looks at the role of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in militarizing rural America. And then in 1970, we learn Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson talked about the division was akin to a beaver because of the agency's, you know, rampant construction of dams. What has the role been of the Army Corps in rural parts of America?
That was a great line from Senator Nelson. I was really pleased to have found that when I was doing my research. So let's imagine a map of the lower 48 states. And I think there isn't a single watershed in the entire continental United States that hasn't been shaped, altered, affected in one way or another by the Army Corps of Engineers. The Army Corps of Engineers goes all the way back to 1774. It's actually the reason West Point was created very early in the 19th century, to produce engineers. And what they have done is to transform the entire the landscape of the nation through the management of water and watersheds, one, as I said, one way and another. In the 19th century, canals. In the 20th century, dams. And so when we think about the way in which rural America is shaped by the federal government, which I think is a really key piece of understanding how rural America operates, the Army Corps of Engineers is kind of Exhibit A. This means irrigation projects. It means flood control projects so that people can live in certain areas which they otherwise might not be able to live in. It's a vast operation. It is more or less unaccountable, the Army Corps of Engineers, I discovered. And its influence has just been profound.
What has its influence been on Native Americans?
Well, I think one of the things that, and I'm going to simplify here, but in the 19th century, the U.S. Army cleared rural, cleared indigenous people out of the country and created a reservation system. Between 1790 and about 1890, there were more than 1,600 military encounters between the U.S. Army and indigenous people of one degree or another. When the Army Corps turns to then reshaping these spaces, Native Americans have often found themselves either flooded out, and I tell the story of the Kinzua Dam Project, which was in sort of on the border between New York and Pennsylvania, in which the Seneca Nation found itself flooded out by a dam project that was built in the 1960s, or they find themselves alternately with water diverted from where they they're now residing because the Army Corps has moved the water in a different direction. So Native Americans continued to be shaped adversely by the Army and the Army Corps of Engineers, even though the military conflicts were officially over.
Turning to military installations, you cite Camp Hood, Texas, as an example of a military installation transforming a rural area. What happens to rural communities when they're made into military towns?
Yeah, two things. Or let's say it goes in two directions. At a place like Fort Hood in Texas, this was a kind of scrubby part of Texas as late as the 1930s. World War II breaks out. The Army decides it needs a big Army base there. So the first thing that happens are all the ranchers and farmers are cleared off the land, eminent domain. And then the land is used for training. It's used for ordnance testing. It's at Fort Hood in particular. They like to roll tanks. So the landscape itself and the environment itself is totally chewed up. But it's an enormous base now with staff and soldiers who are rotating in and out. So let's say the ecology of local businesses changes entirely. Now it's pizza shops and used car dealerships and strip joints, which have replaced whatever used to be there before the Army showed up. The other thing that happens, and I tell the story somewhat closer to Wisconsin of an Air Force base on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, when the Army comes in, or in this case it was the Air Force, when the military comes in, it transforms, as I've just said. But in that case, the base closed in the mid-1990s, and that was like an economic implosion for Marquette County, Michigan, from which it really still hasn't recovered. So when rural communities become dependent on that kind of military spending, when the spending goes away, they're left with real, real economic problems.
You called K.I. Sawyer Air Base the nickname Little Detroit. Can you explain how rural blight occurred in the UP after Sawyer closed?
Sure. Well, when Sawyer closed, and it was a function, there were lots of base closings that were happening at the end of the Cold War. Sawyer was one of those. So all the staff and personnel leave. All of the businesses that service that base leave. Schools begin to close. They can't make their budgets because there are no more kids and there's no more tax revenue. And what this left, therefore, by the end of the 1990s was abandonment and people who were still living there, but living below the poverty line because they didn't really have any options for getting out. So people started to refer to the area around Sawyer as Little Detroit because of the abandonment that was just visible. These small houses that used to have Air Force personnel or whatnot were all just now empty. And it's, I think you see that in a number of places where the military came and then the military left.
We dig into depictions of rural America. Steve Kahn is here, history professor, author of the new book, The Lies of the Land. You can join in with your questions, your perspectives, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Ruth in Ladysmith. Ruth, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering why all the subsidies are going to these corporates, government-funded farms, and not to the hands of the backbreaking family farms. So many family farms have had to close because they do not get the same milk price per 100 pounds of milk that they produce that the big corporate government-funded farms get.
Ruth, thank you. A little bit difficult to hear, Steve, but wanting to have you contrast the subsidies of corporate-funded farms versus what is happening on smaller family farms here in Wisconsin and elsewhere.
So thank you for that question, Ruth. I think there are two answers to it. The most immediate answer is that the agriculture department, starting in the 1950s under President Eisenhower, but then really accelerating in the 1970s under the agriculture department of President Nixon, absolutely wanted to go to, for agriculture to become big and increasingly industrial scale. Some listeners may remember the agriculture secretary under Nixon was a guy named Earl Butz. And his favorite phrase when he would give speeches was get big or go out of business. So he had no use for small scale family style farms. And so ag policy under the Nixon administration was all designed to make agriculture bigger and bigger and bigger, and therefore squeezing out smaller and smaller producers. The second answer to the question is that, in fact, the forces that affect agriculture, you know, sort of making it, squeezing family farms, have been at work for a long time. International Harvester, which again, many listeners are very familiar with, launched an ad campaign in the 1920s where they said, every farm a factory. So the idea that what we really wanted to do was to make agricultural production just as large scale, just as efficient, if that's the right word, as Ford motor cars or what have you, has been going on for over 100 years in this country. And small scale, especially diversified farms, you know, a farm that would grow corn and do dairy, they got squeezed out. And that squeeze, you know, people started talking about that as early as the 1940s and 50s.
And so that's where you hear like the rise of agribusiness and mass produced crops where, you know,
that's right.
Yeah.
These kind of monoculture situations are relatively new, and certainly in, you know, like in the history of agriculture, they're absolutely new. That you would just have 2,000 acres of a single crop, that's really new. But it is all about federal policy that begins under Eisenhower, and as I said, accelerates under Richard Nixon.
Historian Steve Kahn challenging the notion of a rural America in crisis, new book called The Lies of the Land. And you can join the discussion about rural places. Ask a question, share your perspectives at any point. Call in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Hundreds of thousands of jobs are connected to agriculture in Wisconsin, according to state figures. We learn about big forces shaping rural areas, effects on Wisconsin's landscape. Steve Kahn is a professor of history at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. New book is called The Lies of the Land. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Steve, we heard from Rich in Rhinelander, who says that rural areas are often masked by the larger metro areas nearby. Like, people think of Chicago when thinking of Illinois, or they think of New York City, and rather than focus on the entire population of the state of New York. What then happens to that perception when we're totally focused on those huge metro areas?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because I think the traffic goes both ways. I think that while, and I know this from doing my research, that there is a feeling on the part of a lot of folks that all of the attention goes to New York City or Chicago. Politically, it is still the case that rural voters are overrepresented, both at the state level in almost every state, and then, of course, at the national level through the Electoral College and the Senate and so on and so forth. So on the one hand, yeah, it may be that our sitcoms are now largely set in New York City, but in our politics, rural areas are overrepresented. It's true in Pennsylvania. It's true in Illinois. It's true in lots and lots of states. As I said, in addition to our national politics as well.
Mary Lisa from Shawano wants to go deeper on that, and saying that, you know, they live in a rural area that is very red. Mary Lisa wants to know why farmers and people in rural areas often vote Republican, and asks how this loyalty to the Republican Party is affecting rural areas.
Yeah, wow. If I had an answer to that question, because I do think it's in some ways the $60,000 question for politics. So I think that there are a couple of things at play, at least that I have seen. I think since the 1980s, especially with the Reagan Revolution, the suspicion of the mistrust of the federal government has really resonated for rural voters. And I think that was a kind of deliberate strategy on the part of the Republican Party to pit rural people against the government. The irony here, of course, is that the federal government has been essential to what we mean by the development of rural America from the very, very beginning. So let me give you one example. A comparison here. In the 1930s, when the Great Depression begins and Franklin Roosevelt takes office, fewer than 10% of rural households had electricity. By 1960, over 90% of rural households had electricity, and that's all due to the New Deal's rural electrification programs. Okay, fast forward, and what you hear nowadays is that rural America has been cut off from access to high-speed internet, and then everything that descends from that, you know, information, but also its relationship to jobs and whatnot. Well, there have been efforts to try to get the federal government to initiate a kind of rural internet program that would bring high-speed internet to rural areas. That has staunchly been resisted by Republicans over the last decade or so. So when rural voters vote for Republican representatives who then turn around and don't want to do the things, say, that we did in the New Deal, there is a kind of irony here. And I do think rural people have suffered as a consequence.
When you examine federal subsidies, New Deal, the broadband infrastructure of the now, I want to also turn to the Farm Bill. Legislation originally passed in 1973 now contains ag subsidies, money for food stamps, disaster relief. How important is the Farm Bill for American farmers and for rural parts of America?
Well, so let me start by saying that, you know, when I talked about Earl Butz and the Nixon administration, that first farm bill you just referenced, 1973, kind of enshrined many of the things that your caller Ruth was upset about. So in some ways, 50 years after the fact, we're still dealing with the, let's call it the architecture of ag policy that got set in 1973. I guess I would start answering your question, Kate, by saying the Farm Bill affects every single one of us, because what it really does is create the framework for what our food systems are going to be. And I think lots of authors have explored the way in which our food system, if we think of it as a whole, is pretty profoundly broken. But I think what has happened since 1973 is that the Farm Bill, especially the ag part of the Farm Bill, is really dominated by corporate interests, whether that's companies like Monsanto. Well, I guess Monsanto doesn't exist anymore, but it's been swallowed up by something else. But big ag producers, the seed companies and the fertilizer companies that are associated with all of this, and it has a profound impact most immediately on producers, but it has also pretty significant consequences for those of us who have to eat each day.
Is it viewed in smaller towns as a government subsidy, or how is it viewed?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question, and I'm not a journalist, I like to prefer people who are way in the past, and I can get a handle on that. But my suspicion is that, and just from the little bit that I've seen, there are lots of recipients of ag subsidies who do not see this as some kind of a subsidy. They see it as necessary, or that they deserve it, or that it's a vital national interest, and therefore it's not really a subsidy, like people on welfare, let's say, which is the kind of nasty comparison that often gets made. So they, and this, I think, has often been true in rural places. One of the interesting little studies I found, and it was from the 1960s, I think, North Dakota had the highest percentage of residents on some kind of New Deal relief program during the 1930s. By the 1950s and 60s, nobody would acknowledge that in North Dakota. It was as if this collective amnesia about the New Deal had simply descended like a fog over the state. And I thought that was really interesting as a reflection of how people think about their relationship to these federal subsidies.
Steve Kahn with us, history professor, Miami University of Ohio, author of the new book, The Lies of the Land, as we look at depictions of rural America, how it's shaped. You can join in the conversation. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Steve, you say three factors have contributed to manufacturers moving into the South and the Midwest, land, labor, lifestyle. Can you elaborate on what drew them away from urban areas?
So one of the things I think we have to recognize is that the countryside, which we think of as pastoral and so forth and full of farms, is really the site of American manufacturing now. And that was a process moving factories out of big cities into rural places that sort of started in the 30s. It accelerated during the Second World War, and then it really picked up pace in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So there are a couple of things that these factories are looking for. They're looking for cheap land, because then they can build much larger manufacturing plants, usually all on one floor. They're looking for non-unionized labor. When an auto maker moves out of Detroit to build, let's say, in rural Tennessee, they're hoping that the UAW isn't going to come after them. And then they sell the idea that somehow a factory out in the country is going to be, well, it's not going to be dirty, it's not going to be messy or noisy. It's going to take on all of those mythic rural attributes that we believe rural America ought to have. And so this, again, in the 50s and 60s, as this was all being promoted, this is the kind of language that I kept hearing in my sources.
you also do a little case study on Honda and its decision to locate its engine plant in a rural area, specifically Ohio. What have you seen out of companies like Honda who are, you know, building plants in these spaces?
Yeah, so Honda builds its first manufacturing plant in a what was then a small town called Marysville, Ohio. And it's exactly an example of what I was just discussing. It does not want unionized labor at all. And it's very, the company leaders are very explicit about this. And state officials in Ohio, this is in the late 70s, are also very explicit that, you know, if you get your workers from the countryside, they're not going to give you any trouble. They're not going to unionize. They're not going to even try to unionize. And this is very attractive to Honda. Then what Honda does after it opens its Marysville plant is to create like a whole constellation of supplier plants also in really tiny towns. So that, in fact, you can drive through rural Ohio and come across these satellites that are connected to the big assembly plant in Marysville. So the engines are all made in a town called Anna, Ohio, in the western part of the state. It's a town that has 1,300 people in it. More people work at that plant each day than actually live in that town. And I think that's become more and more common across a lot of rural America, especially as the auto industry left the upper Midwest, Detroit, Cleveland, even parts of Wisconsin, and followed I-75 and I-65 south into places like Tennessee and Alabama.
Here in Wisconsin, we've had this multi-year saga with electronics giant Foxconn, has left Mount Pleasant 12,000 jobs shy of what was promised by the manufacturer. What could help communities avoid this dependence on single large employers?
So, yeah, it becomes a really interesting dance. Rural communities want to compete to get these kinds of plants in their town. They throw all kinds of goodies at these companies. But of course, other communities are doing the same thing in this competition. And therefore, it becomes a kind of race to the bottom. How many years of property tax rebates are we going to give you? How much free water are we going to provide from the from our municipal water system? I think that those strategies of economic development work less often than people believe that they do. And I think the, you know, I'm not an economic development specialist by any means, but I think sort of chasing that big white whale of a big manufacturing plant carries at least as many risks and potential pitfalls as it does success.
Miami University of Ohio history professor Steve Kahn's new book, it's called The Lies of the Land, challenging us to rethink what rural means. And there's room to talk. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig into what rural means and the history of these sparsely populated areas in Wisconsin and across the nation. Historian Steve Kahn's book is called The Lies of the Land. Call in with a question. You can share what's on your mind. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Steve, turning to the suburbs established after World War II, built almost entirely on once rural farmland, how did the rise of suburbs transform our rural spaces?
Yeah, I think when we talk about the so-called disappearance of the rural areas in certain parts of the country, what we have to recognize is that they simply became suburban developments. And I was struck that when people have talked about the suburbs, they really have ignored this dimension of it, which is to say that, yeah, all of these big developments get built and still get built on farmland, which means, therefore, that rural communities built around agriculture are displaced or disturbed or distorted one way or another. Often farmers sell up and they go someplace else. Often they get chased out. You know, part of what suburbanites bring is this mythical notion of the pastoral. And then when they discover that it's noisy and dirty and smelly, they go to court to try to close down the remaining farms that are in this area that they like to look at, but they didn't really want to live next to. And I have a couple of, I found a couple of really funny court cases where new suburbanites actually take these farmers to court and shut them down. So I think that the rural dimension of suburban development is something we've really ignored. And what it did to rural and has done to rural communities is a really important story that I tried to tell.
I think it's also interesting how you say that, you know, that there are these fights over sewers and schools and services, you know, but it's also the similar fights that occur in urban areas, that these two areas are not that far apart. Can you talk a bit about that? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think what you need to recognize, or at least that I came to recognize, is that all of the economic forces that affect us all, affect rural people, perhaps in different ways, but they're not separate and apart from any of this. So when we think about a rural area that's maybe growing, this is going to put a strain on everything from the sewers to the schools. And then that makes difficult choices for people who live there. Do we raise our taxes? Because the high school is no longer big enough for all the kids who are now here. But taxes are, we don't like to raise taxes much of the time. Do we build a water treatment plant, or do we continue simply using septic tanks and well water? Right. And so I think these fights happen in every community. The flavors of those fights might be a little different, but they're essentially the same.
You have such an interesting contrast in the rise of rural shopping, and you're looking at retail chains like Penny's and Woolworths in the early 20th century, and then the contrast with Dollar General in Walmart in recent decades. How important were these early dollar stores in the development of rural retail?
I think that was one of the really interesting things that I discovered. When we think about Main Street in some small town in Nebraska, and we think about a mom and pop shop there, in fact, that was really almost never true. What you had on Main Street was a Woolworths or a Penny's, which was a nationally built chain of retail operations, almost exclusively before the Second World War, in small towns and agricultural communities, so that rural shoppers were already connected to national markets of consumer goods through Penny's and Woolworths. The busiest day of the week for many of these stores was Saturday, when all the farm families came in to do their shopping, but they were buying things that were manufactured in Chicago or Philadelphia, or in many cases, London. You were getting the world's goods brought to you through these chains. In the post-Second World War period, those, you know, the Woolworths on Main Street all closed, or almost all of them closed, and they've been replaced with the big box retailers like Walmart. And then I was really fascinated by Dollar General, because there are, you know, we all know Walmart. We know that story. There may be 3,500 Walmarts around the country. There are probably 18,000 Dollar Generals. And they exist almost exclusively in rural communities. And I would argue that they are not doing the kind of service to those communities that, say, the old Woolworths used to. They don't sponsor the Little League team. They aren't a place where you go to have a lunch at the lunch counter and so on and so forth. It's sort of bottom of the barrel, cheap as possible kind of retail.
Mm. Toward the end of your book, you describe American cities as often greener than our country's rural areas. And I mean, I found that really eye-opening. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I think when we think about cities, we tend to think in a kind of old way about, you know, the big polluting factories. So it's, you know, the steel mills of Pittsburgh or whatever it happens to be. But now I think when we are so focused on, as we ought to be, on carbon and energy usage, cities are more efficient energy users than rural areas are. You have to drive less if you have to drive at all. The per capita energy usage in New York City is far lower than it is in any rural community in the country. So if we are going to get serious about addressing the climate crisis, we're going to have to recognize that higher density living is more efficient in terms of energy usage, carbon and other greenhouse gases.
Hmm. I know you liked, as a historian, to stay in your lane in the past, but how should we change the way we talk about rural America? How can we have more productive conversations about the future of rural America?
Well, I think one of the things I've really been struck by is that if we want to really think seriously about revitalizing certain parts of rural America, and again, as I said at the outset, lots of different kinds of rural, I think what we want to start to do is to reinvest in the small cities and even small towns, because I think those, and you know this in Wisconsin, I know this in Ohio, you drive through some of these small towns and they're struggling. But I think that in terms of building an economic base, in terms of building social connections and sense of community, reinvesting in what amounts to the urban areas of rural America is really critical. And I think the kind of low density, very dispersed living that some people have gotten accustomed to is something we ought to move away from.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate
thank
the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Yes.
This was fabulous. Thank you so much.
Steve Kahn is a history professor at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and author of the new book called The Lies of the Land, Seeing Rural America for What It Is and Isn't. You can catch all of our programs online. Visit our program page to stream or download more programs from The Morning Show. Visit wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.